Welcome back to Season 6 of Carmelcast, where this week we are talking about further about the charism, the Carmelite charism, in particular about the charism of prayer and what it means to be praying like a Carmelite. What did Teresa teach about prayer? What was the essence of her teaching on how it is to pray? Today I am joined again by our brother John Mary of Jesus Crucified. Brother John Mary, how are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. Ready to talk about prayer today.
I know this is like the favorite topic of every Carmelite. It's like we could talk all day about prayer. So bring it on. Let's go.
I want to talk in particular, very specific about Teresian prayer and one aspect of that, which is ultimately about prayer as a relationship, which was so important to Teresa. I think it's really at the heart of everything that she taught. You know, if someone were to ask her about prayer, I mean, the first thing that she would say would be a relationship, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and that's really her famous definition of prayer, right?
Yeah. The Book of Her Life, Chapter 8. What is it? Well, I pulled it, because I knew it would come up.
You should read it. That way we don't mess it up by trying to say it from memory.
She says that mental prayer, in my opinion, is nothing else than an intimate sharing between friends. It means taking time frequently to be alone with him who we know loves us. In order that love be true and the friendship endure, the wills of the friends must be in accord. So the first thing when we talk about prayer in terms of Teresa is that relationship, that relational aspect. And it ultimately comes from, I think, something that was a very key distinction for Teresa, which was that prayer is centered around the sacred humanity of Jesus Christ. And basically what that means is that because Jesus was incarnate, because he became man, we now have a human relational aspect of how we communicate and how we live a life with the Trinity. Because God became man, you know, God can be our friend. Because God became man, God can be our spouse. Because God became man, God can be our king. Right? This all stems from Jesus's sacred humanity, which unless he had become incarnate, it wouldn't make much sense for us to speak about prayer as a relationship or prayer as a friendship with Jesus or with God in general, right?
Yeah, and even more than that, I think like this is so central to all of what does it mean to be a Christian. Jesus really is he's the way, he's the gateway into relationship with God. If it wasn't for that sacred humanity, we would have no way to have a true human relationship with God, who's utterly transcendent. And yet he, in his incarnation, has lowered himself, humbled himself to our level, so that through this relationship with Jesus, we enter into relationship with God.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not necessarily about doing anything in particular either. That's what's so beautiful about Teresian prayer, is because it's relational. I mean, think about the things that we do with our friends, and basically it's analogous to what we can do with Jesus in prayer. We can talk to him. We can listen to music with him. We can pray the rosary together with him. There's no really within the body of things you can do in prayer, there's really nothing that's, you know, off limits in that sense. There's not like a particular Carmelite prayer that we have to sit down and do, you know, rotely. It's open to all sorts of things because of that relational aspect that is prayer in Teresa's mind.
Yeah. And that relationship then, it extends outside of the time of prayer as well. It's something that then is with us. It's like saying, you know, if you have a relationship with a friend or with a spouse, it's like, oh, when I'm not talking to that person or when I'm not with that person, like, it's not the relationship ends. There is no relationship, but it in some way becomes a part of who you are. And that person is, in a sense, always with you. And Christ, in a very particular sense, is always with you.
And the flip side of that is also true, right? We can't call ourselves friends of Jesus if we don't spend time with him in an intentional way. So it's definitely a both and sort of situation in that regard. Good. So I think the first, you know, when we speak about types of relationship, human relationships, right? We can talk about friendship. We can talk about a spousal relationship. I think those are the two kind of main ones, right? And so what comes first? You know, obviously we have to have a friendship, you know, so friendship is kind of at the beginning stages, or, I mean, and it's all throughout. It's not like saying, you know, first we're friends with Jesus, and then we're, well, ultimately at the end of time, we'll, you know, Christ is the bridegroom of all souls, that he draws to himself in the end of time in the eschaton. So there is some aspect of that that is true, but within the context of our life lived in a life of prayer, you know, friendship is a good place to start, right?
Yes. Yeah. And that was so central to Teresa, this idea of friendship. And it's something, I think, like you said, it doesn't ever really go away. And same with the relationship you'd have perhaps with a spouse. It's like, it might begin with as a friendship and develop from there. But a true holy marriage is one that is going to, they're going to continue to be these spiritual friends throughout their entire mm-hmm. lives.
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought that in order to sort of break this out and to kind of get really into it, I have these three analogies that I like to use with, you know, helping people to understand how our time in prayer can be more relational and how our time in prayer can be more about spending time with our friend Jesus. And so my first analogy is a backpack. Very simple. And so I have my backpack, it's my prayer backpack, and in my prayer backpack, I have everything that I want to bring with me into my time of prayer. So I have the intentions that I've promised to pray for people. I have, maybe a spiritual book that I want to read. I have the readings for next Sunday for the homily that I have to write, because I want to spend some time in prayer with that passage, obviously. I have the rosary that I want to endeavor to pray daily. Just so much that we intend to do, to bring to prayer. I have that, like that one book that I have, you know, in case things get really distracting, it tends to be really helpful for me in order to kind of get me back on track in my time of prayer if distraction becomes an issue. But the danger in bringing this backpack with us to prayer is that prayer becomes just this checklist of things that I have to get done. And then, like, when we have that sort of mindset about that, then prayer doesn't, it just seems like another thing that we have to do. And I think that can be difficult for us, because then if we're thinking of prayer as just a checklist, well, for one thing, if we were spending time with our friend and, you know, we called them up and it was like, hey, John Mary, let's do something today. First, we're going to pray a rosary together, and then we're going to read scripture together, and then we're going to pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and then we're going to just stare at each other for 45 minutes. I mean, that would be kind of like a weird thing to say to a friend, because it's a lot for someone to handle. It's like, well, you know, maybe we can just see how things are going, and maybe, you know, I don't want to have like this checklist of things to do with this time that we're spending together. So to not make Jesus suffer through that, I think can be helpful mindset for us to have. So one way that I like to see it, and John Mary, you can feel free to agree or disagree with this, but one aspect that I like to have when I go into prayer is I have my backpack on, I'm walking, and it's kind of like in kindergarten when you had a backpack full of stuff that I don't know what was in there, because, I mean, you don't need anything to go to kindergarten. So it may be your lunch or, you know, a stuffed animal or something like that. But the kindergarten teacher ultimately is like going to want to get that stuff out of the way so that you're not distracted about it. So they have these little pegs on the wall, right? And so it's the same thing. It's like being in kindergarten, and Jesus takes the backpack off her shoulders and he hangs it up on the peg, and he just brings us into that relationship, into that time of friendship with him. And then we can always go back to the backpack when we need it, like when things get distracting, when things are difficult, when things are dry. But ultimately, he wants to just spend some time with us and not let the things in the backpack become a distraction in of themselves that are keeping us from really entering into the time of prayer.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great analogy. And I think it can be particularly helpful because the tendency when we go in with this checklist to prayer is that we're the one then taking control and leading the time of prayer. And in reality, like, that is God's work. Prayer is ultimately God's work. And so we want to be free in a way to let him guide us in that time of prayer, to let the Holy Spirit guide us. That might include doing those things, but it maybe isn't in that order or not in the time necessarily that we have, the timetable that we've put out. Instead, it's like allowing God to draw us into relationship, to allow Jesus to draw us into that relationship and to listen to him, let him be our guide.
Yeah. And I think what's really helpful for me is that it eliminates sort of that sense of, okay, I didn't get to the rosary during my hour of mental prayer. Does that mean that the hour, it's like a bust, right? Obviously not. Like the time was spent well, but it exceeded our expectations, or it didn't meet our expectations. But in the end, our expectations don't really matter because it's a relationship, right? And those are bilateral sort of things. And sometimes we have to give and sometimes we have to take. Yeah. And the same is true with our relationship with Jesus.
Yeah, that's a good point, because in a human relationship, if we judged our human relationships like we judged our prayer, it would not be healthy. It's like, I'm going to spend the day with Father Pier Giorgio, and then at the end of the day, I'm thinking, like, judging how the time went of like, oh, I don't think that was a good, this was bad, and this was bad, and I failed in this way and this way. And it's like, no, we just wanted to spend this time together. I can't impose my judgment on it, but rather it's not about fulfilling some or getting things done. It's about the growing in the relationship with one another.
Yeah. So the second analogy I have, and this is sort of like Jesus has hung the backpack on the peg and now he's bringing us in. So what do we do next in our time of prayer? And really, this is just sort of a distillation of the examine. And the way I like to see it is a kitchen table. And I don't know about you, but for me, the kitchen table is sort of a very relaxing place, because it's that place in the morning where we sit and we have our cup of coffee and we're just sort of enjoying the first moments of peace in our day. And then at the end of the day, I mean, probably more so for people who have to commute, but, you know, getting stuck in traffic and then you come home and it's just sort of like that, you know, sitting down and really relaxing for the first time. And maybe you're with your spouse, you know, maybe they've arrived a few minutes before you have. And what do you do when you're there together at the kitchen table in this relationship? Or maybe it's a roommate, whoever it may be. In this analogy, it's really open to anybody. But you sit down at the table and you talk about your day. That's ultimately what people do, right? And so if our relationship with Jesus is a relationship with the humanity of Christ, to let our relationship with Jesus be more human in that way, for the examine to be just like friends coming together for the first time at the end of a difficult or stressful or great or awesome day at the office, or day, you know, spending time with other friends, whoever it may be. But just speaking about that, you know, Jesus, here's where I saw you in this person, you know, Bill in accounting. he was really hard to love today. And so I was able to see you. Or Jesus, I wasn't able to see you in this instance of what was going on today, to just be able to bring that to him at the kitchen table. Because I think what's really powerful about the examine prayer ultimately is that it shapes our ability to see how Jesus is present in our day, to the extent that it becomes habitual, so that it no longer requires like an introspection at the end of the day of going through the time, but then we start to see Jesus in the moment because we've been doing this practice of habitual examining of our day in the ways in which Jesus is present in all of those moments, even when he doesn't feel present, right?
Could you say just a word in a short way, like what is an examine?
Well, I mean, so this is my analogy for it, right? Yeah. An examine is just going through the day, and it could be, you know, it could be in the context of our hour or however long we're going to pray for. Or it can be at other times during the day. We could, you know, there's generally, if you pray the Liturgy of the Hours, there's generally a suggestion to pray an examine, or sort of an examination of conscience, but it can also be more broad, an examine of just going through your day and seeing the ways in which we did well and the ways in which we, you know, didn't do well, the ways in which we sinned, the ways in which we were imperfect. But in this, I think that's more of an examination of conscience. The examine is seeing, is, you know, taking stock of the day and seeing how God was present in that day, so that we can then make acts of gratitude. We can then make acts of faith when we didn't, you know, Christ didn't seem to be present at a particular difficult moment. We can make an act of faith and, no, I know that you are present anyway. even though, you know, it's not always about what I feel or see or understand. You know, I'd make an act of faith to know that Jesus was present, that God was present in those difficult moments. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that's another good analogy, because especially for the time beginning the time of prayer, I just think of, like, if you were to come home to your spouse and just, like, immediately go into, like, something very controversial or, like, deep, not that you couldn't, but usually you would start with, like, well, how was your day? Or you share something about your day. And I think that's important in prayer, because whether we like it or not, we're very much affected based on our mood or what's happened to us throughout the day during our time of prayer. And so it's this way, at the beginning of the time of prayer, we can just kind of give those things over to Jesus and say, here's where I'm at, Jesus. Here's what went wrong today. Here's what went right today. And I'm going to give all that to you. And in a way, it kind of, like, then clears us up and prepares us really to encounter Christ in perhaps a more intimate way during the rest of the time of prayer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's something too that's just relaxing about sharing with a friend about what's been going on. Mm-hmm. And that's why I love the kitchen table, because it's such a relaxing place for me anyway. It's, yeah. You know, it's the center of the family, really, in many ways, of the center of the house. The world revolves around the kitchen.
Yes. Yeah, it's true.
Anyway, so my third analogy then is one that actually I got from you in some way, because of, do you remember? I think I've told you about this once before, this analogy. It's the road trip.
Ah, yes.
And Brother John Mary and I have been on many very long road trips. We've driven across the country, the full breadth of the country, twice together in a Penske truck. But there's something that I realized in kind of those moments of, you know, having to, you know, being Carmelites and having to still do our 2 hours of mental prayer in a Penske truck while we're driving from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles. Remember, is that it's interesting, because you have to, like, then devote this time to silence within the context of being with another person. So it was kind of interesting. I don't know. It analogized the relationship with Jesus in many ways for me, to the extent that I now find it really easy. Before it was difficult, but I now find it very easy to pray in the car. And I have to drive a little bit more than I did as, well, I have to drive more now as a priest than I did as a brother, obviously, because I'm helping out at different churches. But just turning to be able to turn off the radio and just, you know, to imagine the person, the humanity of Christ in the passenger seat, right? Even that empty chair is like kind of an aid to imagine our imagination and imagining him being present with us. But anyway, my analogy, though, is the road trip. And so the road trip is this, I think it's a phenomenon where your friend is going to pick you up. You're going to drive maybe 6 hours away or something like that. You're driving an extended distance. And, you know, they pick you up. You get coffee. You know, in the first hour of the road trip, you're talking, you know, kind of like the kitchen table type stuff, talking about what's been going on. I heard this talk the other day. I listened to this podcast. It taught me this about, you know, the faith that I didn't realize before. And then at some point during the trip, maybe you're listening to music for a little while, but then you're driving through Wyoming and there's no reception. So the music cuts off and there's just the silence, And the person's still there. The peace is still there. It's not awkward. And the reason why it's not awkward, I think, is because there's trust in the relationship. I think when we don't have as much trust or a relationship is new, silence can be really awkward, or it can feel disquieting, even, like we have to fill that space. So to understand, like, within the context of a relationship, if I'm going on a road trip with my best friend and suddenly our conversation sort of ceases, it's not awkward. It's actually really nice. It's this feeling of trust. It's this feeling of sort of mutual support. And it can, you know, the silence is good. The silence is really good. And so to understand kind of in our human relationship with Jesus, in our prayer relationship with Jesus, sometimes we're on the road trip. I think ultimately a lot of times we're going to be on the road trip. We're going to have some periods of time where we're in good conversation, relating to each other in a really human way. But in other times it's going to be more silent. And it's not that something's going wrong. It's just that there's trust in the relationship.
Yeah. And I think even when you were talking about how it's not awkward, I was thinking about how when we first meet someone and you're trying to have a conversation and there's times of silence and it is really awkward. I think especially at the beginning when we're first experiencing this in prayer, it can feel a little bit awkward actually with Jesus. We're like, we feel like we're supposed to fill in that time, or we feel like maybe he's not there or has abandoned us. And just to realize that it takes time then to grow into that comfort and trust with one another, to get to that point where you are totally comfortable, and at times even prefer the silence.
Now wait a minute. is this going back to your relation, your experience of driving in the car with me?
I will say, you and I on our road trips, we had an incredible amount of time of silence, I would say, and I appreciated that. I mean, we had lots of time of great conversation too, but it was a good experience.
Well, it's because I trust you, John Murray. That's Brother John Murray. That's ultimately what it is.
Likewise.
Well, good. So those are kind of, I don't know, my three analogies for thinking about prayer as a relationship, and understanding that, you know, ultimately analogies break down if you push them hard enough. I think they can be helpful though. They help me anyway, especially when prayer is difficult. It kind of gives me a little bit of a framework, but not one that's like very rigid. It's very natural, and because friendship is natural. And so that's what we should strive for in our relationship with Christ.
Yeah.
Ultimately, no, that's great. It's a supernatural reality going on.
Yes.
In the midst of all that, but.
Right. Yeah. No, that's great. And I think it's a good kind of introduction then to this interview that we have to share with you for this week, because it's an interview with a Carmelite nun, and a Carmelite nuns, that's their whole life is devoted to like this life of prayer and intimacy with Christ, particularly as his friend and as his spouse. And so we're very blessed to hear from a Discalced Carmelite nun and hear about her vocation, the way that she's called to live this life of a Discalced Carmelite and the Discalced Carmelite charism, and a life of prayer and intimacy with God.
Praise be Jesus Christ, Mother
now
Celine.
Forever.
It's such a blessing to be here with you, to share and to listen about your vocation as a Discalced Carmelite nun.
Thank you. Welcome back to Loretto.
Thank you. If you wouldn't mind, just please introducing yourself to all of our listeners.
My name is Mother Celine of the Eucharist, and I'm originally from State College, Pennsylvania. It's about an hour away from Loretto. And I'm the prioress here at our monastery named after St. Therese of Lisieux.
Great. Well, I'm guessing that not many of our listeners have had the opportunity to talk with a Carmelite nun before, so this is quite a treat. And I guess I really just wanted to start then at the beginning of the Carmelite nuns. Could you tell us a little bit about the history?
Sure. Well, our history is the same as what the friars, how they started. And it's basically our Holy Father, St. Elijah, on Mount Carmel, and his life dedicated to prayer and devotion to God and seeking union with him alone in the solitude of the desert on the mountain. And eventually, crusaders coming through the area stopped at Mount Carmel and ended up staying there and becoming hermits as well. So gradually, as the hermits moved into Europe, it's a long history, but short story would be Blessed John Soreth in the 15th century, when he united communities of women to the Carmelite order. And so that would be the beginnings of the Carmelite nuns. So eventually the monastery was established in Avila in Spain, and our Holy Mother, St. Teresa of Jesus, entered there originally, spent 20 years of her life devoted to God in prayer at that monastery. But it was one that was very large. At the time, there weren't too many limits on the number of sisters, and ended up being about 180 nuns. And so after a while, after 20 years, she heard God's call to live the primitive rule of the Order of Carmel. And although she was very comfortable at the Incarnation, she had her suite of rooms and all her family and friends around her, she eventually couldn't deny God what he was asking of her. And so she left the incarnation to found the first monastery of Discalced Carmelite Nuns at St. Joseph's in Avila. So that's kind of the origin of the Discalced Carmelite Order. The friars were established shortly after that. And eventually, the nuns moved, they founded monasteries in France. So, and then to Belgium and throughout the world. But France would be the origin of our monastery here. There were two sisters from France who were asked by the bishop to come here and establish a monastery. We started in Altoona, just down the mountain from here, in 1926. So it's been almost 100 years. And in 1930, there were enough sisters to move out of the house. And one of the sisters, actually, I believe the third one to enter there in Altoona, was the sister of Charles Schwab, who was very wealthy businessman in the area, who actually had a summer home here in Loretto. And the prioress at the time sent a little statue of St. Therese up the mountain in a taxi cab and to the Schwab estate. And Mrs. Schwab, the mother of Charlie Schwab, picked it up, and it had a little sign on it that says, "I need a new home." And she said, "Charlie, you need to build a monastery for your sister." So he built this monastery right here with land donated by the TOR Franciscans. And so we're here on another mountain in Loretto.
Yeah, it's amazing to see the continuity between the beginnings on Mount Carmel with St. Elijah and then to this mountain here in Pennsylvania. It's a beautiful history. In these episodes, we're really kind of asking different people, interviewing different people about the way in which that they share in the Carmelite charism, how the Carmelite family is more than just the friars. It also involves nuns and secular order members and even active sisters. And there's many different ways of living that life. So what would you say for you is the way that you see kind of the lens through which you're called to live the Carmelite charism? How is it that you belong to the Carmelite family?
Yes, there's many different ways of looking at it. I think St. Therese probably has one of the most popular ways of looking at it is being love in the heart of the church. So the secular order members and the friars are called to be more directly out in the world, evangelizing, and the cloistered Carmelite nuns are called to be within the cloister, hidden, alone with Christ. It's not often we have interviews. And it's to be love in the heart of the church, singing the praises of God all day long for those who either can or won't pray, and is to a life totally dedicated to Him in solitude and silence in a small community, as in contrast to the Incarnation, the original monastery Holy Mother St. Teresa entered. She wanted it to be a small community of just a few sisters, usually around 13 up to 21 sisters, and to be a small family united in love around Christ.
Yeah, you can see kind of the radicality of that call, of really giving everything that you are, devoting it to that goal of union with God. Mm-hmm. And the means to that really is through prayer, but also love of others. And so that call of a hidden life is actually becomes this beautiful outward witness as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah, a witness that God exists. That's one of the prime reasons. And it's also something that without the existence of God, this life would have absolutely no meaning. There'd be no reason to leave our families, to separate ourselves from wealth and fame and love of a husband, and come here to live separately and alone and apart, unless God existed, unless He was worth giving our entire lives for Him. So even though most people don't see us, that it's the existence of a monastery is just proof, another proof that God exists, because otherwise there's no reason for it. Yeah. And it's a life of love. It's not a life of, some people think women who become cloistered nuns are religious at all must be sad and lonely and depressed and very grim, and it's totally the opposite. Anybody like that, they can't stay in religious life if that's the way they are. But it's a very joyful life, a life of dedication to God in all ways. It's very radical, but it's very joyful.
And there are many kind of, I think, the outward signs of this radical call. I mean, even just the habit that you're wearing, kind of the stark simplicity of the monastery. But I think the most obvious one, especially for those who are watching this on video, are these grates that are in front of you, which is a grill. Can you explain a little bit about what that is?
The grill is obviously a very visible sign of the separation of the cloister from the world, from the people in the world. But it is, it doesn't mean that we hate the world or hate the people in the world. It's a sign of our total dedication to God. I use the example, St. Therese used the love in the heart of the church. Well, the heart is enclosed within the body and is protected by the rib cage. And so I often compare the grill, which is metal and sometimes black. this one happens to be black, but it's protection. And it's an obvious outward sign that's visible that people can see immediately, oh, there's something different here. And it's not a sign, again, of hatred of the world. It's actually, strangely enough, a sign of love for the world. And often I use the example of like a bride and a groom when they're first married. They go off and they want to be separated from everyone to be alone with each other. Because the whole point of this, having the grills, the turns, the barrels that we receive donations or letters or anything come through those means, it's because it's for a person, not for an idea, not for something, but for someone. And for each one of us that is here, it's because God called us, that we heard his call in our hearts and we left everything to follow him. So the grills and all these other signs are just outward symbols to show that reality.
Yeah, and they're really, it's a beautiful way of understanding how it's not a separation from the world, but actually the way in which that you're able to enter more deeply into the world and participate in the sufferings and the joys of the world.
Yeah, people assume that because they look like bars, like prison bars, that we must be in prison and very sad. But we like to say that the key's on our side.
Yes.
We choose to be here. We could leave if we wanted, but we don't, because we love the life. We love our Lord, and he called us here. And people often think that they say, oh, how can you live like that? You're so imprisoned. And we say, well, it looks to us like you're the one behind bars and we're the ones that are free.
It all depends on the perspective.
Yes, yes. I know all of us here that are here find great freedom in this life. And that was sort of the origin of my own call, was the searching for freedom. And strangely enough, discovering it in the cloister.
Yeah. I guess another question that I have then is how this charism that you're called to live as a Carmelite nun, what does that look like then, kind of in the practicalities of your daily life?
It's wrapped up in also my own call. The way, when I started looking to find what religious order to join, one of the things that struck me was this idea that there are people praying all the time, all throughout the day, the liturgy of the hours or the divine office. So these are the psalms of the church, the prayers of the church. And there's specific people in monasteries that are devoted entirely to praying the psalms and the liturgy of the hours. And some who have more active apostolates only pray part of that, and that's fine for their vocation. But I was attracted more to the radical totality of that. And so the singing of the psalms, that was very much something that attracted me. The idea of singing the praises of God, being alone with him and singing his praises, because who is more worthy of praise than God? And so that whole idea of being totally devoted to him and praying the psalms. So that's the core of our day. That's the basis, is praying the psalms all day long, well, it's 7 times a day. But that prayer extends throughout the whole day then. So whether we're doing our manual labor, which is very simple, so we can keep our minds on God, or we're just the spiritual reading, or the times of solitude, and then also the times of community recreation, which our Holy Mother, St. Teresa, was very wise for us in asking us to have 2 hours of recreation. Because she knew if we didn't have times where we could speak to one another, that it would be much harder to keep the silence. So we also have that, hours of recreation, but all of this is permeated with the whole idea of prayer. It goes throughout the whole day.
Yeah, we can see the continuity of the zeal that St. Elijah had there on Mount Carmel for, mm-hmm. for union with God alone, and how that's lived in your life. So then every aspect of your life, whether it's the times you're in formal prayer or the times you're recreating and talking with your sisters, the times of work, the times of eating, mm-hmm. The times of worship and celebration, they're all ordered towards this one goal. And that's, yeah, I think that's something so beautiful about your life, is how vivid that symbol is of the centrality of that union with God, mm-hmm. relationship with Jesus. We've been seeing how the different ways that the Carmelite charism is lived as nuns, as friars, as secular members, how they're all kind of working together, supporting one another in this beautiful unity, and how we're not separated in that call.
Yeah, so for we do share the same charism. One of the differences is that the friars are called to be out in the middle of the battle and leading the charge, so to speak, but the Carmelite nuns are meant to be, our Holy Mother, St. Teresa, compared us to standard bearers, and we show the way, but we hold the flag, and the friars are the ones who are out in the thick of the battle fighting. The secular members are fighting. And we are also compared to Moses on the mountaintop, who, with his arms outstretched in the form of a cross in prayer, prayed for the victory of Joshua and the armies of Israel. So it's similar that's our call on the mountain, to be in prayer so that the armies of God will win. And so our call is not to be in the thick of the battle, all that sometimes happens. We're called to be up on the mountain separate and praying for those in the world who are fighting the battles.
Yeah, I remember reading a quote from Pope Francis, mm-hmm. where he talks about how the prayers of contemplative women are really what supports the entire world, even though it's something that's totally invisible. But it's through their prayers and grace that really the rest of us can go about our daily lives,
yes.
and fight that battle, as you
yes.
mentioned.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's another aspect that really attracted me, was prayers for the Holy Father, for Pope Francis now, currently, but for the Holy Father, for priests and seminarians and missionaries. That's another aspect of the Carmelite nuns, that we're devoted to praying for priests. And so it's prayers for the church, for the whole world, but specifically prayers for priests and missionaries and for the Holy Father.
And what was your journey like then that led you to Carmel?
It started out pretty early. My mother is a convert, and so she converted at 19 to Catholicism, and she loved our Holy Mother, St. Teresa. So her first daughter was named Teresa, so that's me. So I grew up knowing about St. Teresa herself, but not a whole lot about the Carmelite nuns that she founded. And so when I was growing up, I had two older brothers, so I was a bit of a tomboy, and I was always getting sap in my hair and ripping my clothes, and my mother fixed me up at the end and say, if you don't calm down, I'm going to send you those Carmelite nuns in Loretto, and they'll straighten you out. And so I thought it was a reform school, and I'm thinking, I hate those Carmelite nuns in Loretto, I'm never going there, never, never. So I had that idea in my mind, but as I grew older, I was very attracted to the arts and photography, and I thought, I'm going to be a freelance photographer. That's what I'm going to do, travel the world. So I was heading for a Master of Fine Arts in photography mostly, and when that wasn't working out, I'd been accepted to graduate school, but I had no way to get there and didn't have any money, so there was a little problem. So I started praying the miraculous 54-day rosary novena, after my mother's example. And during that novena, I remember that I became more and more quiet and separated from my friends. I was just not going out with them as much. I wasn't watching movies or television. And I was just really concentrated on this idea of prayer. But my whole goal was, Lord, show me how to get what I want. And I kept repeating that. Show me how to get what I want. Because I thought what I wanted was God's will. And as things were progressing during that novena, I realized that nothing was changing and something had to change. So I said, well, Lord, if this isn't your will, what is? Show me what you want. And so my prayer gradually changed without realizing it into, show me how to get what I want, to show me what you want. Mm. And as I kept repeating that and the novena was progressing, eventually he told me, he said, I want you to do what you're doing. And I was totally shocked because my whole idea had been, you know, freedom out in the world, living for myself, which I thought was a good thing. But I realized he was calling me to something else. And I said, Lord, you don't realize that the only people who do what I'm doing are nuns. And then when I realized he wasn't giving me any other answer than that, I said, oh, no. So I said, well, I'm not going to enter those nuns in Loretto. So God had a different plan. So I started doing my research. And it gradually led me to the attraction that I mentioned for the divine office, for the totality of that. And eventually I realized that that meant cloistered contemplative life. And so little by little, it led me to back to the Carmelite nuns again. I said, okay, who's the closest to home? Because my family's going to have a hard time with this initially. And so I looked and the closest ones were Loretto. No. So God has a sense of humor, but he led me straight back to Loretto. And so I've been here ever since. I've been here 30 years.
Wow. So. Yeah. It's amazing to see how God transforms your idea of freedom. Mm-hmm. Because before what you thought you were seeking in freedom, it turned out to be something very different. And then Now you feel like you've been given this freedom.
Absolutely.
In Christ.
Yes. Before, what I thought was freedom was actually slavery, living for myself and myself alone. But now it's living for the church, living for the people in the world, for my family, for God. And so that's the whole idea of freedom, and that's what truly makes us happy.
Yeah. So what advice would you give to someone who feels that maybe God is calling them to consider a vocation to become a Carmelite nun?
I would say don't be afraid, first of all. You know, definitely you can look online, but don't believe everything you read. Definitely you want to ask people who know what the life is like, and then don't be afraid to go look, to actually investigate and go yourself and visit monasteries, especially Carmelite monasteries, and see what the life is really like, and then don't be afraid. You're not going to be unhappy. If this is your vocation, it's going to be the joy of your life.
Mm, yeah, that's great advice. One final question that I have for you is there any particular Carmelite writing that's really has had a profound impact on your vocation as a Carmelite nun?
Yes, but I can't limit it to just one. I would say the big three would be Our Holy Father, St. John of the Cross, Our Holy Mother, St. Teresa, and St. Therese. And St. Therese, her writings, primarily the story of a soul, were given to me when I was just graduating from college. The first chapters of Story of a Soul were the ones that struck me the most. And so her daring trust in the fatherhood of God and his love specifically for her, that struck me very much and led me into my first, I think, moments of prayer, where I was really pondering what that really meant and drawn into the life of the Trinity, I think, through that. Our Holy Mother, St. Teresa, obviously has been a devotion from the time I was a child, but I'm drawn to her letters and her Book of Foundations, mainly because they show her a much more conversant style and how she relates directly to people, and her great humor and her radicality really come through in those writings. You see her as a real person. And also her love for St. Joseph, who I love very much. So our glorious Father, St. Joseph, her devotion to him was really profound. And then as I entered the novitiate, I began to have more struggles in prayer and not knowing how to speak about it or what that really meant. I had remembered, they always said, you got to read St. John of the Cross. And so I looked at his writings. I wasn't so attracted to the Living Flame or the Spiritual Canticle, although now they're beautiful, but it was The Dark Night and the Ascent of Mount Carmel. And once I was permitted to read those, all the lights went on. And so I've been very, very much a friend of St. John of the Cross ever since, because all the answers were there. He's so scriptural, and he has a way of bringing the gospel into the life of prayer that's just remarkable. Mm. And so it's been very helpful for my spiritual life.
Yeah, you really can't go wrong with Teresa, yeah. John, and Therese. So.
I have lots of other favorites, but those are the three.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Mother Celine, for this has been a really great blessing just to get to listen to you as you share about your vocation.
And thank you for coming.
Yes, we really appreciate it. God bless you.
Thank you. You too.
everyone, Brother Pier Giorgio here. Thanks for checking out this episode of Carmelcast. If you want to hear more of us, don't forget to click subscribe. Also, be sure to click like if you enjoyed this episode, and maybe even leave us a comment. We post discussion questions down below to get the conversation going. Want more information on Carmelite spirituality and the Discalced Carmelite Saints? Then you'll want to check out our website, www.icspublications.org. There's a link in the description of this episode. From here, you can see all our current promotions and access our complete catalog for the writings of St. John of the Cross, St. Teresa of Avila, St. Therese of Lisieux, St. Elizabeth of the Trinity, and St. Edith Stein. If you want to stay up to date on all our promotions and new titles, then be sure to add your email to our email list. There's no better way to stay up to date on the latest Carmelite publications. Thanks for joining us, and may God bless you.